The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
At the age of just 20, an American student called Amanda Knox travelled to Perugia in Italy to study with the view to becoming a translator. But what started off as a semester abroad for the young American quickly became a nightmare. Amanda became the focus of frenzied international media attention when she was accused of the murder of her flatmate, a British student, Meredith Kircher. On November the 6th, 2007, Meredith Kircher was found murdered in the apartment that she shared with Amanda Knox in Perugia. And inexplicably, Amanda Knox became the prime suspect in the case and was later arrested along with her new Italian boyfriend, Raffaele Solicito. Italian prosecutors painted the murder as a drug-fueled sex game gone wrong. A court later convicted Knox and Solicito of sexual assault and murder. Now, the case dominated international headlines with every lewd and gruesome allegation by the prosecution painted as fact, and Amanda was dubbed Foxy Knoxy. Amanda Knox spent 4 years in prison in Italy before DNA evidence categorically proved her innocence and saw a man named Rudy Guido sentenced for the murder. In 2015, Italy's highest court overturned Knox's conviction, but she'd also been convicted of maliciously accusing a bar manager of Kircher's murder during the initial police questioning on November the 6th, 2007, and that was not reversed. She said the sensationalised narrative created by the prosecution and the media was difficult to overcome even after her release. Well, now, in her second memoir, which is called Free, Amanda Knox writes about her attempts to adjust to normal life after leaving prison in Italy. I spoke with her on her arrival in Ireland on Friday, and we talked about her experience 10 years on and why she had chosen to write a second book.
Yeah, so my first memoir, Waiting to Be Heard, was really about setting the record straight. This book is a very different book. I think that it's really about when you have gone through a traumatic event, how do you then incorporate what you have learned into your life, and how do you be informed by what you've experienced instead of be defined by what you've experienced?
You start the book by giving a summary, a brief enough summary of your situation in litigation at the moment, because it's not definitively over.
Right. Well, ironically, my book is called Free, and in many ways, I'm not free. I still remain wrongly convicted of a lesser charge in Italy related to the coerced statements that I signed during my interrogations that the European Court of Human Rights found were in violation of my human rights. So there's an ongoing journey to be vindicated and really freed by the Italian justice system. But I think one of the big messages that I want to convey in my book is that you don't need your external circumstances to be perfect for you to be okay and to be an effective agent in your own life.
Now, when I look back on the account of what happened, and we're not going to go into the detail of what actually happened because
it's out there.
There's nothing to
We've
do.
Been there.
No, it's nothing to do with you, really.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever traces of DNA were there were completely explainable because, after all,
I lived in the place.
Yeah. And there was an individual who was convicted and got out after an extraordinarily shortish time.
Yes, 13 years he served, and now he's on trial for sexually assaulting another young woman since he's got
out. This was a man with that kind of history behind him.
Yes.
And whose DNA was found absolutely on the scene.
Yes.
So it should have been game, set, and match. You should have been the witness, not the accused.
Exactly. And I think that if this story had been told correctly, no one would ever know my name. I would be one of Meredith's... Yes, a footnote in the history, very much like Meredith's other roommates. But of course, the prosecution and the detectives really decided upon a narrative very early on and pursued that narrative in spite of the exonerating evidence in the case.
Now, in the early stages when you thought you were a witness and you were being, you didn't realize this was an interrogation and that you were in fact a captive.
Yes, I did not understand. In fact, a lot of what I do now today, when I talk about criminal justice reform and I do a lot of advocacy work, a lot of it has to do with what happens behind closed doors between police officers, law enforcement professionals, and the people that they are serving and protecting. I came home, I discovered a crime scene, I called the police for help. I arrived at the police station, made myself utterly available to the police, did exactly everything that they told me to do, because as a 20-year-old girl, I had zero context for understanding how to engage in this situation. It was totally overwhelming and shocking, and I was betrayed. And I shouldn't have been betrayed as an indirect victim of crime.
But you're an American abroad, and you're only 20. I mean, you're young, you're naive.
Yes.
Absolutely, as most 20-year-olds are.
Yeah.
And suddenly you find yourself in this situation. How long did it take to dawn on you how deep the trouble you were in?
It came in stages, Pat, because, there were certain points where I thought, oh, God, this is all just this big misunderstanding. And if only the adults in the room will just sort of agree upon what the facts of the case are, I'll be okay. And my family very often talked about it as if I was in this long, dark tunnel. There's this metaphor I talk about in the book of, are we in this dark tunnel and there's a light at the end of the tunnel? Or are we in a dark room and the light has to come from within us? And there was this moment, this shift in that I talk in the chapter called Epiphany, where I was convicted. I showed up in the courtroom fully expecting to be freed and allowed to go home, acquitted, because it was a preposterous story to begin with, this death orgy between two young women, like insane. But I was convicted, and I realized that the truth didn't matter, that it was really a narrative that had taken over, and a false misogynistic narrative to boot. And now I had to make sense of, oh my God, this is my life. And I think this is how, my first book was a lot about just this crazy experience that I had gone through. It was very extreme experience. And one thing I really want people to understand when they read Free is that, yes, the circumstances that I was in were very extreme. Not everyone gets accused of murder and then put in jail for something they didn't do, right? But ultimately, I do think that all of us at a certain point in our life realize, oh my God, this is it. This is it. How do I make this life worth living? And,
a parallel would be, say, someone who's in a catastrophic car accident.
Absolutely.
And suddenly from walking around playing sport, they're now confined to a wheelchair.
Exactly.
And you've got to say, this is it.
This is
the way I'm going to be.
Yes. And can I be okay? And can I be not just defined by this terrible experience, but informed by it?
How much did you know about the characterization of you that was being portrayed in media?
I was very ignorant. Again, I was very young and I was in a jail cell for much of this time. So I only had limited access to what was happening in the outside world. My family would come and visit me and say, this thing has blown up, it's gotten out of proportion. But I really didn't know until I came home
When you'd been released?
When I was released and I was like, on a flight back to the United States from Italy, and every single news station was my face and my name. And I came home not to a world that I had recognized, where I was an anonymous college student that I had been dreaming of going back to. But really, I was entering into a new kind of prison, which was the prison of public opinion, of judgment, of being followed around and literally stalked by paparazzi for months on end. And as a 25-year-old, living under the pressure of realizing that I was not just, an anonymous college student, I was now the girl accused of murder. And even if I had proven my innocence from this day forward, every single day, I would have to prove my innocence over and over and over again by either being invisible or perfect.
You talk about the narrative that the police had constructed in the Italian court, and it portrayed you as a sexual deviant.
Mm.
And they used a nickname that you'd got from your sporting prowess on the soccer field.
Yes.
To kind of twist that into something else.
Yes. So there were a lot of nicknames for me, but the one that really captured the world's imagination was my soccer nickname, Foxy Noxie. I was a defender. I chased after the ball. It rhymes with Knox. Ta-da, there's my nickname. But it got turned into this wicked fox idea, this like cunning seductress idea. And I knew it was a cheeky nickname. That's why 12-year-olds give each other cheeky nicknames.
And your teammates had nicknames too.
Absolutely. Martini. Jennifer Martinez was Martini, and my friend Trisha was called Trash. Like, it was fun, just like jokey between girls. And then it just got magnified out of proportion because, again, this idea that was really packaged by the prosecution and sold by the media was women on women violence. This idea that women all secretly hate each other, are in sexual competition for each other, and really this dichotomy of what kinds of women there are. Both Meredith and I were distorted into these dichotomies of like the free-spirited whore and the judgmental virgin. And that's not who either of us were. But it captured the world's imagination. It was pornographic in nature, and it ultimately like made it impossible for anyone to really recognize the truth of what had happened to my roommate.
You were definitively vindicated, absolutely, and the real perpetrator identified. So you would think it should be a big welcome home, and this is an innocent girl, an innocent American abroad, who has been, if you like, hit upon by a judicial system that's not fit for purpose. And we'll talk about the prosecutor in a moment or two. But instead, you found that interviews that you gave or statements that you made were always tinged with that sense of, well, maybe she's guilty.
Right. And another reason why I wrote this book is this idea that a wrongfully convicted person's whole story is encapsulated in the trial, right? That there's a crime, there's the trial, there's, and then they get out of prison, ta-da, the end, nothing else happens. But actually, I really feel, and you know, you mentioned before that all of that stuff isn't really my story. And I agree with you, because that was all just stuff that happened to me that I didn't really have a say in. And it was only once I was able to return home and plant down roots and make decisions to confront the trauma that I had just experienced that my story truly began. And part of that was grappling with this ongoing stigma, first of all, of being the girl accused of murder. But even more insidious than that, Pat, was the simple fact that my life, who I am, my identity, was now intricately wrapped up with the death of my friend. I went from just an anonymous college student to a girl that is associated with a horrible crime that happened to another young woman. And so on top of just the normal survivor's guilt that anyone in my position might feel, like if none of the trauma of the accusation and the imprisonment ever happened, I still would be traumatized from having come home to discover my house had been broken into and my roommate had been murdered. And that somehow, just by a twist of fate, I was lucky enough to meet a boy 5 days earlier and slept over at his house instead of being raped and murdered too.
So people forget you could have been the victim.
Absolutely. I absolutely could have been a victim. And that was one of the first things that sort of I was struck with, in that when I finally realized what had happened to Meredith was, oh my God, that could have been me.
Yeah.
And so grappling with survivor's guilt of realizing two young girls at the prime of their life went to go study abroad and only one of them got to go home, that is there. But then there's the survivor's guilt by proxy that I'm put through, where people always compare me to my dead friend and sort of think that somehow, I talk about this in the book, of this single victim fallacy idea that in these complex stories of tragedy, there can only be one true victim.
And we'll have more from Amanda after this break.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, you analysed the way media treated you and treated any aspect of your story, whether it was an appeal, the conviction, whatever it was, and that the tabloid media would treat it in one way. But then so-called mainstream, respectable media would sanitize it, but still tell the story with all the insinuations.
Right.
And that really got to you. And you give an example of Chris Cuomo, who used to work for CNN before his brother's difficulties in New York, and his standing by his brother, I suppose. And you talk about, you know, he says to you, I'm going to have to ask you tough questions, but more or less that's to allow you to rebut everything that's being said about you.
Right. It'll be good for you. Yeah.
But then most of it ends up on the cutting room floor.
Yes, exactly. And I think that that was a huge learning experience of really understanding how the sausage gets made, honestly. I mean, now you and I are both media professionals. We understand that oftentimes there is already a spin to the story before the conversation is even had. And I think really responsible journalism doesn't just arrive with a conclusion before you've had the conversation. And it's something that I am always thinking about. You know, I have a podcast, Labyrinth, that I make with my husband. And one of the a big series we did was called Blood Money, which was about like, what is the history and ethics of true crime? How do we tell these stories and why? And at the time, the story was simply to make money. And it wasn't really interested in, and of course, we also know between us that media is at a crisis point. The economics of it don't make sense. We don't have the ability to investigate stories the way that we used to. And so we're constantly relying on oftentimes tabloid media to provide us with sources. And it's just, it's a mess. So I think as consumers of media, we should be wary of when a story appears to us with heroes and victims and villains and nothing in between. And it's something that really informed my decision to create a relationship with my prosecutor.
And we'll talk about him, because this is an extraordinary part of your book, which it culminates really in your book is moving towards that
moment.
It
drives towards it, yes.
Yeah. But all along the way, there are moments of hope, I suppose. You're not religious, but you met a priest in prison, Don Saulo.
Yeah, this necklace is what he gave to me. I remember apparently it's got religious connotations. It's like the Holy Spirit or something like that. But he knew, I mean, he and I had wonderful debates in prison about philosophy and all of that. And I think he gave me this also to just as an acknowledgement of my innocence and of the ability to be free, regardless of our circumstances. I think one conversation that I had with him that really shifted this feeling of just like dread and despair that I was experiencing from this recognition that this is my life, but oh my God, my life is unfair. And is this life even worth living? I had very real conversations with myself about that.
And you discuss how inmates in the prison would choose to take their own lives using anything that was available.
Oh, absolutely.
But you also concluded that you were not that person.
No, I was not that person. Also because of this conversation, like Don Saulo would often talk to me in these like metaphors or these analogies. And one that really stayed with me was when he simply said, you know, if you pray to God for strength, he doesn't give you strength. He gives you the opportunity to be strong. And just that framing really gave to me a new way of looking at my life and thinking, okay, well, if this is an opportunity, what is this opportunity for? And so in the prison environment, instead of imagining myself this competitor for the scarce resources that were available, I instead thought, well, how am I a resource for this community? How do I have a role here? What is meaningful to me? What is my ikigai, my raison d'être? And I realized, ironically, I had gone to Italy because I wanted to be a translator. And suddenly, after I became fluent in both prison and courtroom Italian, which are very different, I could be a translator for the many, many, you know, foreign women who were in this prison. Or I could write letters even for Italian women who were not able to read and write. And that was shocking. But then, of course, I had to do that whole thinking all over again when I got out of prison and I sort of entered a world that didn't seem like it had a place for me, that I was very much told to just shut up and disappear or otherwise be absolutely perfect and graceful, but in mourning for the rest of my life. I was very much boxed in and I didn't feel like I had the ability to be a person or have a role in the world. And it took just meeting other wrongly convicted people, other vilified women, to get a sense of like, there is a path for me, there is a place.
But that took a while, because it was only when you met people from the Innocence Project that it kind of gelled with you.
Yes. And only after
I am not alone.
Exactly. And also after making many mistakes. I think something that really needs to be talked about is how after someone has been traumatized, after they've gone through an existential crisis, there is this cognitive opening that makes us very suggestible, impressionable, and impulsive even. We are just clinging to anything that can give us a sense of being grounded or a sense of being understood. And I trusted the wrong people at certain times in my...
And you're quite frank and open about...
Yes. And I think that's very important because... Again, like I was being held to an impossible standard of like perfection. I could not make a mistake, but here I was inevitably making mistakes like we do in our 20s anyway. But of course, after a traumatizing incident, and I don't think anyone who has been traumatized and is then sort of clinging for any sense of being grounded should be judged for those kinds of mistakes.
Now, you were found innocent and then you entered into a correspondence with your prosecutor.
Yes.
And it emerged... Well, kind of slowly through your correspondence that he inherited the narrative from the police.
Yeah.
He wasn't there from the beginning. He didn't come up with this sexual deviance story. It was handed to him and he went with it, which, of course, you have to challenge why he did without questioning and asking himself, am I doing the right thing? But why did you want to communicate with him and kind of reconcile with the man who had really tormented you?
Well, I had him in my mind as this boogeyman, as this person who had ruined my life for no reason. But I also knew that that wasn't a true vision of who this man was, nor did it give me any sense of understanding of why this was my life. Why did this happen to me? Why did he look at a 20-year-old traumatized girl and see a monster? And why did he pursue a case against me when very clear evidence came in fairly early on that indicated who really had committed this crime? And so when I reached out to him, I reached out in a non-adversarial way. I did think that some aspect of the criminal legal process, in the same way that sometimes, especially in the United States, politics, like if you're on the right or the left, you just cannot see, you can't even agree on facts, much less opinions. And so I wondered if I could just meet him outside of the criminal justice system in a non-adversarial way, could he see that I was not the person that he thought he was prosecuting? I really hoped that if he did, he might then proclaim it from the rooftops and I would be freed and I would be okay. And it was only over the course of years of correspondence and then finally coming in direct contact with him that, first of all, I made the choice to not have my well-being depend upon this man seeing the light, but also realizing that it wasn't my relationship with him, wasn't just needing something from him, it was me having something to give him. And when that switched for me, I went from feeling utterly powerless to unstoppable.
I think we should let readers of the book uncover
yes.
exactly what happened. But suffice it to say, you went with your family.
I did.
For this meeting. And we will, as I say, let our readers of the book draw their own conclusions. How are you today? I mean, do you have flashbacks? Do you ever revisit those times, whether it's the trauma of the evening itself or the trauma of prison and the trauma of hearing yourself declared guilty in court, which I think must be the stuff of nightmares?
Yes. I mean, the worst experience that I ever had was when I was being interrogated by the police. And I was made to feel insane by authority figures that I had been raised to trust and obey. So that experience is very triggering. And when I still to this day feel uncomfortable around police officers, not because I don't think that they have an important job. They absolutely do. Again, I was an indirect victim of crime before I became a victim of the criminal justice system. But at the same time, I feel deeply uncomfortable knowing how much power they have over any one of us. And so I feel very uncomfortable around them in ways that I don't like. I wish that I could feel more at peace with that group of people, knowing how important they are for society, but I can't help it. And I do. I think looking back on those times, I get very triggered when I feel like somebody, especially an authority figure, is lying to me. It scares me. It sends me into panic attacks. But also I do have dreams of being in prison. And it's but honestly, I think that today, despite all of those things, and maybe in part because of all of these things, I also feel very free in ways that I might not otherwise had this experience not happened to me, because I know how precious this moment is, and this moment is all we have. And I, you know, there are things in my life that I grieved in prison because I thought I wouldn't get to have them, like a family and children. And today I do have those things. So I think that on the one hand, there is that ongoing lingering trauma, but it also informs my sense of just gratitude to be alive.
The book is called Free, and I found it an inspirational book. I felt I, for the first time, really, I got to know Amanda Knox.
Thank you.
In a way I hadn't been able to do before. But I have to tell you, though, when I mention to someone I'm interviewing Amanda Knox about her new book, which is called Free, people say, oh, Foxy Knoxy. That's still there.
Yes, of course. Well, it was spoon-fed to everyone for so long that, of course, it's there. And I think that that's one of the ongoing dilemmas of my life is before I enter into a room, Foxy Knoxy is already there. And I'm always in conversation with this idea of me in people's minds. And I think that that's an interesting lesson for any one of us, because I believe that all of us have that issue. We just don't realize it. There's an idea of Pat in people's minds, and there's an idea of, you know, black woman in one other person's mind. And so I think we're always in conversation with these images that people project onto us. Mine just happens to be very specific.
Do you think you'll ever be able to reclaim the Foxy Knoxy of the soccer pitch?
Oh,
for Amanda Knox?
You know, my children, I would love for them to play soccer. And so I think once I start kicking the ball around, maybe I can bring Foxy Knoxy back.
Amanda, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Pat. I love
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.